Okay, so you're interested in modern Islamic movements, like Salafism, but you want to get beyond the headlines. To really understand it, we need to go back in time, all the way back to the 13th century.
That's right. The roots of modern Islamic movements run deep, and to understand them, we need to meet a figure who's been called both a fundamentalist and a reformer.
Okay.
Ibn Taymiyyah.
Ibn Taymiyyah. Honestly, the name doesn't ring a bell, but you're saying this guy from the 1200s is relevant to understanding movements like Salafism today.
Absolutely. Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas, controversial in his own time, have had a surprising and lasting impact. Think of this deep dive as a journey through time, connecting the dots between a medieval scholar and the modern world.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What kind of sources are we diving into today?
We've got a fascinating mix. We'll be drawing on historical accounts of Ibn Taymiyyah's life, YouTube lectures that break down complex theological debates, and even scholarly discussions on the evolution of Islamic thought.
Sounds like a serious deep dive. So where do we start?
Well, to understand Ibn Taymiyyah, we need to understand his world. Imagine the Islamic world in 1263. The Mongols have just sacked Baghdad, ending the Abbasid Caliphate.
Wow, that's huge. The Abbasid Caliphate was one of the most powerful empires in the world at that time. It'd be like if, I don't know, if the United States suddenly collapsed.
Exactly. It was a moment of profound upheaval and crisis for the Muslim community. This is the world Ibn Taymiyyah is born into, a world grappling with questions of decline, reform, and what it means to be a true Muslim in a time of chaos.
So how did this backdrop shape Ibn Taymiyyah's thinking?
Well, it instilled in him a deep concern for the fate of the Muslim world. He saw laxity and deviation from what he considered the pure form of Islam as contributing to its weakness.
Okay, let's talk about Ibn Taymiyyah himself. Who was he and what made him so controversial?
Ibn Taymiyyah was a brilliant scholar, a jurist and theologian known for his fiery personality and unwavering commitment to his beliefs.
So what were his beliefs? What made him stand out from other scholars of his time?
He was deeply critical of what he saw as innovations in Islam, practices and beliefs that had crept in over the centuries.
What do you mean by innovations? Can you give us an example?
Think of it this way. In Islam, the Quran and the Sunnah, the Prophet Muhammad's teachings and practices, are seen as the primary sources of guidance. But over time, different interpretations and practices emerged.
So you're saying Ibn Taymiyyah was a purist?
Yes, you could say that. He believed that any practice or belief not explicitly rooted in the Quran and Sunnah was a dangerous deviation, a bid'ah, which is an Arabic word for innovation in religious matters.
Okay, I see where the controversy might come in. Isn't there always debate about how to interpret religious texts? I mean, isn't even the compilation of the Quran itself considered an innovation?
That's a great point. And you're right, the compilation of the Quran was an innovation, but it was one that most scholars accepted as necessary and beneficial. Ibn Taymiyyah, however, took a much more radical stance. He believed that all innovation was wrong, regardless of intent.
So even things like, say, using microphones in mosques to amplify the call to prayer, or printing copies of the Quran for wider distribution, he would have considered all of that wrong.
Exactly. He advocated for a strict return to what he saw as the practices of the earliest Muslims, the Salaf, the first three generations after the Prophet Muhammad. This is where the term Salafism comes from.
So Ibn Taymiyyah's rejection of all innovation was pretty radical for his time, and this idea is at the very heart of Salafism.
Exactly. And it's a key takeaway as we start to explore Ibn Taymiyyah's impact on later movements. But before we jump ahead, let's dive into some of the specific ways his views challenged the status quo in his own time.
Sounds good. Let's unpack this further.
One of the areas where Ibn Taymiyyah's views really clashed with the mainstream was his criticism of Sufism.
Sufism. Remind me, what's Sufism again?
Sufism is often described as the mystical dimension of Islam. It emphasizes inner spiritual experience, seeking a direct and personal connection with God. At the time, Sufism was very popular with widespread Sufi orders and practices.
So how did Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas clash with Sufism?
While he wasn't entirely against Sufism, he acknowledged that some early Sufi figures adhered to what he considered authentic Islamic practices. But he saw many Sufi practices as straying from the straight path.
Could you give us some concrete examples?
Take grave visitation, for example. Many Sufis would visit the tombs of saints and righteous people, seeking their blessings or intercession. Ibn Taymiyyah saw this as bordering on idolatry, a form of worship directed towards someone other than God.
And wasn't there a big controversy involving Ibn Taymiyyah and a Sufi leader?
Yes. Ibn Taymiyyah publicly condemned these practices, and this led to a famous confrontation with a prominent Sufi leader named Ibn Atallah. Imagine this. Ibn Taymiyyah marched to Ibn Taymiyyah's mosque with 500 of his followers to protest against his views.
Wow. That gives you a sense of how high the stakes were in these theological debates.
Absolutely. And this clash between Ibn Taymiyyah's strict, literalist interpretation of Islam and the more mystical, experiential approach of Sufism is a key theme that runs through his life and work. But it wasn't the only area where his views sparked controversy.
So what else got him into trouble?
Ibn Taymiyyah also challenged the traditional way Islamic law was interpreted. At the time, Islamic legal scholars relied heavily on precedents set by earlier scholars. They would look at how previous generations had interpreted the Quran and Sunnah and apply those rulings to new situations.
So it's kind of like how lawyers today cite previous court cases to support their arguments.
Exactly. But Ibn Taymiyyah argued that this reliance on legal precedents had led to stagnation and corruption. He advocated for a more direct approach, emphasizing independent reasoning, or ijtihad as it's known in Arabic, based on a fresh interpretation of the primary sources, the Quran and Sunnah.
So he was basically saying, don't just blindly follow what others have said before. Go back to the source and figure it out for yourself.
That's a great way to put it. And this emphasis on individual interpretation and a direct connection to the sources of Islam is another key element of Ibn Taymiyyah's thought that would have a profound impact on later movements like Salafism. But there's another layer to the story that adds a layer of complexity.
Okay, what's the twist?
While Ibn Taymiyyah championed going back to the sources, his own interpretations were often influenced by the particular school of Islamic law he belonged to, the Hanbali school, known for its strict and literalist approach.
So it's kind of ironic, right? He was advocating for independent thought, but he was still shaped by his own tradition.
Exactly. It highlights a key point we see over and over again in history. Even when we think we're being completely objective, our own background and experiences inevitably influence how we see the world and how we interpret texts.
This reminds me of that quote, "We don't see the world as it is, we see it as we are."
Yes. It's a powerful reminder that even the most brilliant minds are not immune to their own biases. And it's something to keep in mind as we continue to explore how Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas have reverberated through history.
Okay, before we go any further, let's do a quick recap. What are the two key takeaways so far about Ibn Taymiyyah and his legacy?
The first is his radical rejection of all innovation, the idea that any practice or belief not explicitly found in the Quran and Sunnah is a deviation from true Islam. This idea would become a cornerstone of modern Salafism.
And the second?
His emphasis on ijtihad, on independent reasoning based on a direct engagement with the Quran and Sunnah. This idea, while often applied within the framework of his own Hanbali school, would also resonate with later reformers who sought to reinterpret Islamic law in light of modern challenges.
Okay, so we've got these two seemingly contradictory ideas, a strict adherence to the past and a call for independent thinking. It seems like Ibn Taymiyyah was a pretty complex figure.
He was. And that complexity is part of what makes him so fascinating. But his controversial ideas about Islamic law weren't the only things that landed him in hot water. He also had some very unique and controversial views about the nature of God.
Okay, let's talk about that.
To understand Ibn Taymiyyah's theology, we need to understand the intellectual landscape of his time. There were different schools of thought within Islam, and one of the most influential was Kalam theology.
Kalam theology. Refresh our memories on what that is. It sounds a bit intimidating.
Don't worry, it's not as complicated as it sounds. Imagine trying to describe the ocean to someone who's never seen it before. You might use metaphors like vast, powerful, deep. You're trying to convey a sense of the ocean without literally describing its physical form.
Okay, I see where you're going with this.
That's kind of what Kalam theologians were doing when they talked about God. They were influenced by Greek philosophy, which emphasized God's absolute transcendence, his existence beyond our human comprehension.
So they were trying to describe God using concepts that go beyond our limited human understanding.
Exactly. So when the Quran uses words that seem to attribute human-like characteristics to God, like hand or face, Kalam theologians interpreted them metaphorically. They'd say, God doesn't literally have a hand, but this verse is talking about God's power.
So it's all about interpretation.
Right. But here's where Ibn Taymiyyah comes in with a very different perspective. He rejected the abstract philosophical approach of Kalam theology.
What did he believe instead?
He argued that the descriptions of God in the Quran should be taken at face value, that we shouldn't limit God based on our human conceptions.
Wait a minute. Are you saying he believed that God literally has a hand? That sounds like anthropomorphism, attributing human characteristics to God.
It's not quite that simple. While Ibn Taymiyyah rejected outright anthropomorphism, he insisted that God possesses qualities as described in the Quran, but in a way that befits God's majesty, not in a human way.
Okay, now I'm really starting to see why he was considered so controversial. Mm. His theological views seem really hard to pin down.
They are, and that's why Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas about God continue to be debated today, especially among Salafists who draw heavily on his thought. So, was he an anthropomorphist, as some accused him of being, or was his understanding of God more nuanced than that? It's a question worth pondering as we delve deeper into his legacy.
Okay, so we've established that Ibn Taymiyyah was a controversial figure in his own time, but it's mind-blowing to think that his ideas, which seemed pretty radical back then, are still shaping the world today. How did that happen? How did a 13th century scholar become so influential centuries later?
It's a remarkable story. Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas didn't exactly have an immediate impact. In fact, for centuries after his death, his writings were mostly known only to a small circle of scholars.
So if his ideas weren't widely known, how did they end up influencing movements like Salafism?
That's the million-dollar question. It's a combination of factors. Think about it. Ibn Taymiyyah called for a return to the purity of the early days of Islam, a rejection of what he saw as later innovations and deviations centuries later, as the Muslim world was facing new challenges, colonialism, modernization, the rise of secular ideologies. His ideas resonated with those who longed for a return to a more authentic and, in their view, purer form of Islam.
So it's like his ideas were waiting in the wings, ready to be rediscovered and reinterpreted in a new context.
Exactly. And this is where figures like Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab come into the picture.
Ah, the founder of Wahhabism. So this is the connection to Saudi Arabia.
Precisely. Ibn Abd al-Wahhab, an 18th century scholar from the Arabian Peninsula, was deeply influenced by Ibn Taymiyyah's writings. He saw in them a blueprint for reviving Islam and purging it of what he considered corrupting influences.
So Ibn Abd al-Wahhab took Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas and applied them to his own time and place, leading to the emergence of Wahhabism as a powerful religious and political force.
That's a great summary. And as you know, Wahhabism eventually became the dominant form of Islam in Saudi Arabia, profoundly shaping the kingdom's religious, social, and political landscape.
Okay, so that explains the link between Ibn Taymiyyah and Wahhabism. But what about Salafism more broadly? You said earlier that Ibn Taymiyyah is considered a key figure in Salafism, but his ideas weren't widely known for centuries. How did they make a comeback?
That's where the story gets even more interesting. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, there was a growing movement of Islamic scholars who were rediscovering Ibn Taymiyyah's writings. These scholars, often based in places like Egypt and India, saw in Ibn Taymiyyah a champion of their own, call for a return to the pure Islam of the Salaf.
So it's like a revival movement within Islam, drawing inspiration from a medieval scholar who seemed almost forgotten.
It is. And these scholars weren't just rediscovering Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas. They were reinterpreting them, adapting them to the challenges of their own time.
So it wasn't just a blind imitation of Ibn Taymiyyah, but a creative re-engagement with his thought.
Exactly. And that's one of the key things to understand about Salafism. It's not a monolithic movement frozen in time. It's a dynamic tradition that has evolved over time, adapting to different contexts and drawing on a variety of sources.
Okay, I'm starting to get a better sense of the nuances here, but we need to make sure we're not painting too simplistic a picture for our listener. When most people hear the term Salafism, they think of extremism, terrorism, even ISIS. How do we reconcile that with what you're saying about Salafism as a diverse, evolving movement?
That's a crucial point. It's essential to understand that Salafism is not inherently violent or extremist. In fact, the vast majority of Salafists are peaceful and law-abiding.
So what are the different types of Salafism?
Think of it as a spectrum. On one end, you have the quietest Salafists.
Quietest, meaning they're quiet, they keep to themselves.
Yes. Generally speaking, they focus on personal piety, purifying their own religious practice and avoiding political involvement. They often see the world as corrupt and believe that the best way to live as a true Muslim is to withdraw from society and focus on individual religious observance.
So they're not out there trying to impose their views on others or change the political system.
Exactly. Then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the jihadist Salafists like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. They believe that violence is justified to achieve their goals, which include establishing an Islamic state and implementing their strict interpretation of Sharia law.
Okay, so those are the two extremes. But what about the space in between? Are there Salafis who are politically engaged but reject violence?
Absolutely. That's where the activist Salafists come in. They believe in working within the existing political system to promote Islamic values and implement Sharia law as they understand it.
So they might participate in elections, form political parties, or advocate for changes in legislation.
Exactly. And within this activist Salafi camp, you have a wide range of views and approaches. Some are more pragmatic and willing to compromise, while others are more ideologically rigid and confrontational.
So when we talk about Salafism, it's crucial to remember this diversity to avoid the trap of lumping everyone together.
Absolutely. The word Salafism often gets thrown around in the media without much nuance, and that can lead to harmful generalizations.
Okay, I'm glad we clarified that, but I think our listeners are probably wondering, how did Salafism become such a global phenomenon? I mean, it seems to be everywhere these days.
It's a great question, and the answer is complex. It's not just about the rediscovery of Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas. Mm-hmm. It's also about the way those ideas were spread and promoted in the 20th and 21st centuries, and here's where Saudi Arabia's role becomes crucial.
Okay, let's talk about that. I know Saudi Arabia is often associated with Wahhabism, which we discussed earlier, but how does Saudi Arabia fit into the broader picture of Salafism globally?
Well, as we've seen, Wahhabism itself is a form of Salafism deeply influenced by Ibn Taymiyyah. And since Saudi Arabia became a wealthy and powerful nation in the 20th century, it has used its resources to promote its own version of Islam around the world.
I've heard the term Saudi Dawah thrown around a lot. What exactly does that mean?
Dawah is often translated as invitation or call to Islam. But when we're talking about Saudi Arabia, it's much more than that. It's a massive, multifaceted apparatus with a global reach encompassing everything from building mosques and funding Islamic schools to distributing religious literature and sponsoring scholarships for students to study in Saudi Arabia.
So it's like a massive PR campaign for their version of Islam.
That's one way to look at it. And it's been incredibly influential in shaping how Islam is understood and practiced in many parts of the world. But here's where things get even more interesting.
Okay, I'm all ears.
This whole apparatus of Saudi Dawah isn't some monolithic entity controlled by Riyadh. It's a complex network of actors with varying levels of autonomy and sometimes even competing agendas.
So it's not just a top-down operation.
Exactly. You've got government ministries like the Ministry of Islamic Affairs that fund and oversee Dawah activities, but you also have semi-public organizations like the Muslim World League that are largely funded by Saudi Arabia but operate more independently.
And then there are all those charities. I've heard about Saudi charities building mosques and schools all over the world.
Yes, a whole network of Islamic charities, some large and well-known, others small and family-run. And while much of their work is legitimate humanitarian aid, there have been reports of pressure on aid recipients to adopt Wahhabi practices.
So it's like soft power, using aid and development projects as a way to spread religious influence.
Precisely. And then there's the media landscape, satellite TV channels, online platforms, all bankrolled by Saudi money. It's a powerful force for spreading Wahhabi ideas and interpretations of Islam.
This whole Saudi Dawah thing is sounding pretty complex. Is there anything we can say about its impact? Has it been successful in spreading Wahhabism globally?
It's definitely had an impact. One of the most visible impacts has been a tightening of norms around women's modesty in many places where women didn't traditionally wear full face veils, the niqab, for example. It's become increasingly common, often linked to Saudi influence.
And what about religious minorities?
There's evidence that the rise of Wahhabi interpretations of Islam has led to increased discrimination against religious minorities in some countries. This is particularly true in places where there's already underlying social tension or conflict.
So it's not that Saudi Dawah directly causes conflict, but it can exacerbate existing tensions by sharpening religious differences and creating a more exclusionary social climate.
That's a key point, and this is where the question of sectarianism comes in. Wahhabi thought is deeply anti-Shia. And there's no doubt that Saudi Dawah has contributed to rising sectarian tensions in some parts of the Muslim world.
This is especially concerning in places like Iraq and Pakistan, where Sunni-Shia conflict has been a major source of violence and instability.
Right, and while it's difficult to establish direct causal links, there's a strong argument to be made that the influx of Wahhabi ideas and funding has contributed to fueling sectarian animosity.
Okay, let's address the elephant in the room, the link between Saudi Dawah and violent extremism. It's a complex and controversial issue, and we need to be careful about making sweeping generalizations.
Absolutely. It's crucial to remember that the vast majority of Salafists are not violent extremists. In fact, many Salafists condemn violence and terrorism.
But there's no denying that some extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS draw inspiration from Wahhabi thought.
They do. And the question is, to what extent has Saudi Dawah contributed to creating an environment where those extremist ideologies can flourish?
This is where it gets really tricky. There have been anecdotal reports of Saudi-funded mosques preaching extremist views or serving as recruiting grounds for militant groups. But it's hard to get reliable data on this, and the issue is so politically charged that it's difficult to separate fact from fiction.
It is, and we need to be cautious about drawing simplistic conclusions, but I think it's fair to say that in some cases, the kind of rigid, exclusionary worldview promoted by Wahhabi thought can create a fertile ground for extremist ideologies to take root.
So it's not about Saudi Arabia directly funding terrorism, but about the kind of religious ecosystem that their Dawah activities have helped to create in some parts of the world.
Exactly. And this is where understanding the nuances of Wahhabi thought is so important. The emphasis on dividing the world into true believers and unbelievers, on judging others based on their perceived adherence to strict religious norms, that can create a dangerous mindset, one that dehumanizes those who are seen as different or outside the fold.
It's a sobering thought, and it underscores the need for a more nuanced and critical approach to understanding the impact of Saudi Dawah.
It does, and we need to go beyond just looking at the funding flows and institutional connections. It's about understanding the ideas, the interpretations of Islam that are being spread, and how they can impact social dynamics, political discourse, and even the potential for violence.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground in this section about the global impact of Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas, the rise of Salafism, and the complexities of Saudi Dawah. Before we move on to our final part, let's do a quick recap to make sure we're connecting this back to our listener.
Great idea. So remember, even though Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas weren't widely known for centuries after his death, they experienced a revival in the 19th and 20th centuries, inspiring movements like Wahhabism and contributing to the global rise of Salafism. But it's crucial to remember that Salafism is not a monolithic entity. There are different types of Salafism, from quietist Salafists who focus on personal piety, to activist Salafists who engage in politics, and even jihadist Salafists who advocate for violence.
And while Saudi Arabia has played a significant role in spreading its own version of Salafism, Wahhabism, through its massive Dawah apparatus, it's important to note that this apparatus is not some centrally controlled machine. It involves a complex network of actors with their own agendas and motivations.
Exactly. And the impact of Saudi Dawah has been multifaceted, leading to both positive contributions like providing religious infrastructure and negative consequences like the potential for increased sectarianism and the spread of intolerant views.
Okay, so we've seen how Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas have traveled through time, shaping the religious landscape of the modern world. But the story doesn't end there in part three. We'll explore how this story continues to unfold, looking at the evolution of Saudi Dawah in recent years, the impact of new technologies, and what the future might hold for movements like Salafism.
I'm looking forward to unpacking these final insights with you.
So we've seen how Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas have echoed through history, shaping movements like Wahhabism and the Salafism. And we've unpacked the complex world of Saudi Dawah with its mosques and schools and charities, spreading a particular interpretation of Islam across the globe. But here's the thing, the world is constantly changing. How is this story evolving in the 21st century?
That's where it gets even more fascinating. Think about it, we're living in a digital age, an age of instant communication and social media. This has had a profound impact on how religious ideas are spread and how movements like Salafism operate.
Okay, so how has Saudi Dawah adapted to this new digital landscape? Are they tweeting out fatwas now?
Well, not quite. But you're right, social media has become a major tool for Saudi Dawah in the past. They relied heavily on traditional institutions like mosques and universities. Now they have a much more direct channel to reach global audiences through online platforms.
So they can bypass those traditional gatekeepers and spread their message directly to individuals.
Exactly. Think about it, with a single tweet or Facebook post, they can reach millions of people. Instantly, they're creating slick videos, engaging infographics, even online courses, all promoting their interpretations of Islam.
It's like a digital Dawah revolution.
It is. And this presents both opportunities and challenges. On the one hand, Saudi Arabia can use social media to promote a more tolerant and inclusive vision of Islam, to counter extremist narratives and build bridges with other faiths.
Of course, there's a flip side to that coin.
Right. Social media can also be a powerful tool for amplifying hate speech and creating echo chambers where extremist ideologies can flourish. It's a double-edged sword.
So how do we navigate this new landscape? It seems like we need a whole new set of skills to be informed citizens in the digital age.
Absolutely. We need to be savvy consumers of information. We need to question what we see online and be wary of sources that promote hate or intolerance.
It's like we need a digital version of Ijtihad that independent reasoning Ibn Taymiyyah advocated for. We need to use our own judgment and critical thinking skills to navigate this online world of information overload.
That's a brilliant analogy. And these skills are essential for everyone, not just Muslims. We're all bombarded with information from all sides, and it's up to each of us to sift through it to discern what's credible and what's not.
Okay, so social media has definitely changed the game for Saudi Dawah, but are there other factors that are shaping its evolution?
Yes. Remember how we talked about Saudi Dawah not being a monolithic entity, but rather a network of actors with sometimes competing agendas? Well, those internal dynamics within Saudi Arabia itself are also shaping the direction of Dawah.
What do you mean?
Well, Saudi Arabia has been undergoing some significant transformations in recent years, especially under the leadership of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He's been pushing for economic diversification, social reforms, and a more assertive foreign policy.
So how do these changes impact Dawah?
One of the most notable shifts has been a move away from the more hardline, explicitly Wahhabi interpretations of Islam that were dominant for decades.
So are they promoting a more moderate form of Islam now?
It's more complicated than that. While they're cracking down on extremist groups and trying to project a more tolerant image of Islam internationally, they're also tightening their grip on religious discourse within Saudi Arabia itself.
So it's a balancing act.
Yeah.
Trying to appease both international and domestic audiences.
Exactly. And this has led to some interesting contradictions. On the one hand, they're promoting interfaith dialogue and condemning terrorism. On the other hand, they're still arresting and silencing dissidents, including those who advocate for more progressive interpretations of Islam.
It sounds like Saudi Dawah is at a crossroads. It's trying to adapt to a changing world, but it's still grappling with its own internal contradictions and competing agendas.
That's a great way to put it, and it makes predicting the future of Saudi Dawah and its impact on global Islam incredibly difficult. We're in uncharted territory.
Okay, so let's zoom out for a moment and think about the bigger picture. We started this deep dive with Ibn Taymiyyah, a 13th century scholar whose ideas seem radical in his own time. But as we've seen, his legacy has been long and complex, shaping movements and impacting lives across centuries and continents.
It's a reminder of the enduring power of ideas, how beliefs can shape societies and inspire movements.
And it's also a reminder that the story is still unfolding. We're witnessing the evolution of Islamic thought in real time, shaped by social, political, and technological forces.
It's an exciting time to be studying these issues, even if it's sometimes challenging to keep up with the pace of change.
Speaking of change, I'm curious to get your take on this. As the internet continues to redefine access to information and religious authority, how do you think movements like Salafism will evolve?
That's the million-dollar question. I think we're already seeing some interesting trends. On the one hand, the internet has empowered individuals to seek out information and interpretations of Islam outside of traditional institutions and authorities.
So it's challenging the old hierarchies of religious knowledge.
Exactly. And this has created space for more diverse voices and perspectives within Islam, including those who are promoting a more progressive and inclusive vision of the faith.
That sounds hopeful. But isn't there also the risk of the internet becoming an echo chamber for extremist views?
Absolutely. And that's the challenge. The internet can be a tool for both good and bad.
Yeah.
It's a battleground for hearts and minds, and it's up to each of us to be critical thinkers, to engage in respectful dialogue, and to promote understanding across differences.
Well said. So as we wrap up this deep dive, what's the one key takeaway you want to leave our listener with?
I want them to walk away with a sense of wonder and curiosity. The world of ideas is vast and complex, and there's always more to learn. Keep questioning, keep exploring, and keep engaging with the world around you with an open mind and a critical eye.
That's the perfect note to end on. So to our listener, I hope this deep dive has sparked your curiosity and inspired you to continue exploring the fascinating world of Ibn Taymiyyah Salafism and the evolution of Islamic thought in the modern world. Until next time, stay curious and keep learning.